So when we were thinking how to begin, this idea came into my head, and I totally own it. It wasn't Tennessee. But years ago, we found this welcome, and it's a welcome that's posted on a church. I think it's a Lutheran church in Colorado. I'm not sure. But it's so inclusive. And at first, we were attracted to it because it's kind of cute, you know. It's kind of funny and it's very creative. But then we reflected on just how inclusive it is. And so, since we're talking about inclusivity and welcoming strangers, we thought to open with this welcome that's posted on a church in Colorado.
A special welcome to those who are single, married, divorced, gay, filthy rich, dirt poor, y no hablas inglés.
A special welcome to those who are crying newborns, skinny as a rail, or could afford to lose a few pounds.
We welcome you if you can sing like Andrea Bocelli, or like our pastor who can't carry a note in a bucket.
You're welcome here if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail.
We don't care if you're overdressed, cross-dressed, more Catholic than the Pope, or haven't been in church since little Joey's baptism.
We extend a special welcome to soccer moms, NASCAR dads, starving artists, tree huggers, latte sippers, vegetarians, and junk food eaters.
We welcome those who are in recovery or still addicted.
We welcome you if you're having problems, or you're down in the dumps, or you don't like organized religion. We've been there too.
If you blew all your offering money at the dog crack, you're welcome here.
We offer a special welcome to those who think the earth is flat, work too hard, don't work, can't spell, or came because grandma is in town and wanted to go to church.
We welcome those who are inked, pierced, or both.
We offer a special welcome to those who could use a prayer right now, had religion shoved down your throat as a kid, or got lost in traffic and wound up here by mistake.
We welcome the flexible, inflexible, tolerant, intolerant, those who laughed, and those who gasped at this welcome.
We welcome tourists, seekers, doubters, bleeding hearts,
and you.
It's kind of cute. So it's important for Tenzi and I to just state right at the outset that the invitation to welcome the stranger, in our view, is just that, an invitation. It's not a requirement. As the Reverend Robert Thompson states, as quoted by Mirabai Starr in her book, the heaven to which Jesus points is the spaciousness within ourselves, one that makes room for those who threaten us, for those who are different, even for those who have betrayed us. Our hearts are restless for that heaven to which Jesus points. We welcome the stranger not to make points with the stranger, or to make points with our own egos, or even make points with God. We welcome the stranger because when we do, we find the gratitude and joy that accompanies a coming home to the kingdom to which Jesus invites us, and a fulfillment of an innate longing in our souls to be welcomed and to welcome. A transformation from an us-them to just an us occurs when we recognize the stranger in ourselves that has been accepted. So like the man in the gospel who asks Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" we might ask, "Who is the stranger?" It is important that the question not come from a place of wanting to justify ourselves, because, again, we are not being asked to welcome the stranger. We are invited. We are offered a gift. But the most likely opportunity to receive that gift is when we welcome those as Reverend Thompson suggests, who threaten us, those who are different, even those who have betrayed us. The Beatitudes, in our view, are the template of the heart of Jesus. The Beatitudes are the starting point, they're the signposts, they're the trailhead, so to speak, for the kingdom to which Jesus points. Kenzie and I have experienced both welcoming the stranger and being welcomed as the stranger. We thought to share a few of those experiences with you as a way of acknowledging that in our lives, at least, we find the gospel to be true.
And so very much keeping in Catholic worker tradition and in the sense of table fellowship, stories really are the glue that keep us together. And among the favorite things Catholic workers like to do is just share stories, share our experiences, and that's what we're bringing to you today. And so from our perspective as Christians, as those, as people who are wanting to follow Jesus and what we think of as his manifesto in the Beatitudes, we're remembering something that Greg Boyle spoke to us many years ago when he translated the blessed are you in the Beatitudes as you're in the right place. You're in the right place. So one beatitude that I felt was maybe lacking when Jesus was standing there at the mount was, blessed are those who fear, for you will be shown courage. And in this case, it was I who was the stranger and as such was filled with a lot of fear. Having heard the stories that Dennis and others told of their experiences in prison, I had some apprehension in thinking about what it would be like for me to be in prison for the 7 days that Judge Lamothe sentenced me for having crossed the green line at Vandenberg. I'd been in prison many years before for acts of civil disobedience, but truth be told, I felt I was a little out of practice. So when I finally arrived at the prison, I knew that I was in the right place as fear came knocking at my door. The guards were gruff, and because I was the only woman being processed on this particular day, I had the added pressure of being processed with over 40 men in holding cells right next to me, and when they passed through in front of my cell, the catcalls and the rest. Having been stripped and given the standard jumpsuit, I arrived on the women's unit by 8 p.m. The guard barked out, "Take your mat to your cell." "I'm sorry, where is my cell?" I said. The guard responded, "I said, take your mat to your cell," and I'm sure it was with the look of utter confusion or fear or both that immediately had two women prisoners come to my aid and carry my mat to the cell that had an empty cot. Upon arriving, the three other cellmates introduced themselves and offered me food that they'd saved from dinner. I shared the sack lunch I had been given, and they freely helped themselves to my chips and sandwich that I had brought. It was our version of potluck meal shared. Soon after, they were sharing their extra clothes with me so I could change out of the oversized jumpsuit. They also shared the hygiene products I'd need as well. Within the first 30 minutes of being in prison, I was being offered hospitality and warmth by the very women that society casts away as criminals. Initially in prison, there's an etiquette about what is spoken about. You never ask why someone's there. But with time, and in my case it was an hour, the women were curious, and so I told them why I was there and immediately they made the connection. I must be anti-Trump, which was okay by them because they also disliked Trump. Among the fears I had before entering prison were two, and those were being cold and having headaches from the coffee withdrawal. They intentionally keep prisons cold so as to try and control tempers and just keep prisoners feeling on the cool side. You're issued a shirt, a pair of pants, socks, and one blanket, and all those are given the day after you arrive. So it's up to you to figure out how to make it until you're given those items. And each of the three women cellmates contributed towards dressing me so that I could be warm my first night. The next morning, as I went to morning breakfast, I was greeted by a woman offering me her instant coffee grounds so that I could add to my hot water. That was offered the first day, and again every day I was there by a different woman. All ethnicities are represented in prison. The Latinas were like my sisters, and I, of course, felt very comfortable in their presence. The white women were equally easy to get along with. The African-American women were beautiful and very accepting of me. But the Asian women were the ones I didn't feel I had as much in common with. It was while sitting in the outside rec area that I struck a conversation with them. Of all the people that seemed out of place, they by far stood out. Their culture and general demeanor seemed so different than the rest of us. But it was while spending time with them that I realized that, like the rest of us, they just wanted to be with their kids back at home and with their families. And despite the cultural differences, they all shared the pictures of their children when they came in the mail. Our hearts melted, and all of us delighted in them. I was very lucky because the floor wasn't filled to capacity. To find a place on the unit that was a little bit quieter than the rest of the places, I pulled up a chair and spent time reading and writing in this place. I wrapped myself in my blanket and spent hours reading in this priceless place of quiet. I kid you not, one woman came to me with a cup of tea and said that I looked so comfortable that all I needed was a cup of tea to complete the picture. The same woman was looking at 10 years. The only problem was that she found out that she was pregnant when she arrived in prison. She was okay, though, because she'd found out that it was going to be a girl, and she'd always wanted to have a girl. And her mother would be there to help take care of her until she got out. Not a trace of bitterness. She had great faith. Barry, my cellmate, was schizophrenic. She heard voices and spoke to them on occasion. I would sometimes hear Barry sing, and she had a beautiful voice. When I was needing encouragement, she'd sing me spirituals. Miss T, she called me. Let me sing you something. But what's most amazing about this story is that many weeks earlier for prayer, I had selected an old spiritual to share with the community. And the title was Order My Steps. And there was something about this song that was just very touching to me. And so I'm on the bunk, and Barry says, let me sing you something. And I said, I'd really like that, Barry. And she started singing Order My Steps, never having known that that song had touched me so much. My time at MDC, Metropolitan Detention Center, truly renewed my hope in humanity. I felt privileged to be in the right place, and the courage I received was to know that I participate in a human family that shares and is more alive from a place of need and degradation than from a place of surplus and wealth. The spaciousness of heart was mirrored in all of them.
So I have a story as well, and I just want to say, we're not going to tell all prison stories, I promise. But it is a prison story, mostly because Kenzie and I thought ahead of time we should maybe share the experience of being welcomed as a stranger first, because we do a lot of welcoming in Guadalupe, but we sort of feel like if we didn't have that experience ourselves of being welcomed, that maybe we wouldn't be so aware to pass that along to the people that come to us. So I would say that Tenzi's experience in a women's prison was different from mine in a men's prison, because women are women and men are men. That's about the best I can put it. In a men's prison, there's these racial divisions that are really hard and fast. There, the white people stay with the white people, the black with the black people, the Latinos with the Latinos, and so on. And never the twain shall meet, I guess is how they say it. So even the tables, there's a big common area where maybe 130 men are seated eating. You have to, if you're white, you sit at the white tables. If you're black, you sit at the black tables and like that. It's very, very, and you can get in trouble for fraternizing with the wrong person in prison, in a men's prison. So when I was there, there was this 2-week period. I was 4 months at the Metropolitan Detention Center in LA, and there was a 2-week period where I got sent to solitary confinement. And I won't go into that whole story, but it was a tough 2 weeks. But the night that I was returned to my floor, and I was grateful to be returned to my floor from solitary, just happened to be the same night that on television was the Democratic National Convention. And all the men were sitting in the common area watching the television as Barack Obama gave the keynote address at this convention. And I sat at the white table, where I'm supposed to sit, and a little ways over there was one of the black tables. And anyway, I happened to be sitting next to this guy. I'll call him Brian. It wasn't his real name, but I do remember it starts with a B. Anyway, Brian was mentally challenged. He had sort of been abusing drugs for too long, and his brain was not working quite right. Well, during Barack Obama's speech, Brian stood up, and he started just bad-mouthing Barack Obama. And as he got louder and more caustic, he began bad-mouthing African-Americans in general. And the tension, even though everyone kind of knew Brian was not quite right, the tensions just started building. You could feel it. And I'd look over at the black table, and I'd look at Brian, and I was thinking, this is not going to go well. This is not going to go well. And I was scared, but I thought, I probably need to respond somehow. And I thought to confront Brian, but Brian would have just escalated. Brian did not like to be confronted. So instead, almost instinctively, I didn't really think it out. I just stood up, and I walked over, and I just stood next to the black table. I just separated myself from Brian and stood over there. And almost immediately, Brian stopped. And to my surprise, one of the men at the black table stood up from his seat and asked me to sit in his seat. That was a risk. That was a risk at that table. And I sat in that seat feeling uncomfortable and worrying about the man who had offered me a seat, when the black man on my left leaned over, gave me a knuckle punch, and said, "Welcome back." He knew that I had just gotten out of the hole. Never had a conversation with this man. Didn't really know his name, nothing. But he knew I had gotten out of the hole. He wanted me to know that he respected that I had endured that deprivation and came back. So, you know, here we are in a place where it's really, really hard to welcome a stranger because there's consequences to it. And here I was being welcomed as a stranger in this place. So we've had a lot of experiences of welcoming the stranger ourselves at the Catholic Worker. Our experience is almost always the same. In the welcome, we are welcomed. And so we'll tell a couple stories about that.
And before we share more of those stories, we just want to pause to reiterate our understanding of the importance of welcoming the stranger. Heaven or the kingdom of God are experienced as a felt sense when we identify with others rather than judge others. Both Mirabai Starr and our dear friend Greg Boyle refer to this felt sense as spaciousness, a breaking open of the heart that goes beyond just a bleeding heart to a heart that is broken open and immersed in the oneness that transcends our separateness and reminds us that we are in fact members of one body. This is why we see the welcoming as an invitation, because the gift we receive is the treasure in the field for which we will sell everything just to own. And now we have a couple more stories.
Yeah, I'll go first this time. So, in Mirabai's book, you know, she mentions Dorothy Day, and she mentions the Catholic Worker. Dorothy Day founded the Catholic Worker movement, and she was really fond of quoting Fyodor Dostoevsky. I think I said his name right. But this is what he had to say. Love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams. Dorothy liked to quote that a lot. Love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams. So we can talk about welcoming the stranger, but sometimes to put that love into action is a little more harsh and dreadful. And I just... We thought to maybe address that a little bit, because it's true. We could go through story after story of examples of our hearts being broken open by the strangers we've welcomed, but we could also tell stories of welcomings that have gone sour and wrong. And I want to include that because I don't want to sugarcoat our experience. I don't want to pretend that you set out to be a welcoming person and everything goes great, because it doesn't always. And, you know, we often think of Jesus asking for forgiveness for the soldier that crucified him, or Jesus who had dinner with the man he knew was betraying him and ate with him. So here we go. We welcomed a family, it was a dad, a mom, and two small children, into our house because the father was out of work and they didn't have any place to stay. So we said they'd come and have a room in the house. In the very next room was another woman who was a single mom. She had three kids. She was in that room. She had been the victim of domestic violence and was there by herself. So one evening, the father from the first room comes home drunk as a skunk. And instead of going to his room, he goes to the single mother's room and puts the moves on her. And she had to come to us for help. And we had to ask the man to leave the house. We let his wife and kids stay, but he had to find another place to stay. But the feeling is like a betrayal. You know, you think you're being magnanimous. You're offering somebody who's really in a tight spot a place, a salvation, so to speak. And then we felt like he betrayed us. And then the question is, how do you navigate that? How do you not let that harden your heart and say, what was I thinking? I won't do that again. You know? So this other situation was just from this past Christmas. So a woman came to us for help. Now, this woman we knew. And she, the previous Christmas, not this Christmas, but the previous Christmas, one of our supporters had wanted to support a family, and we put him in contact with this woman. So he bought her kids toys, and he bought food for the family. It was very nice. But this Christmas, she came to us because there was no offer for someone to help her kids, and she knew that the Salvation Army was giving out toys for kids. But when she went there, they said, "We need a copy of your kids' birth certificates because we need to document who we gave toys to so people aren't, you know, like hoarding toys." So she came to Tenzi and she said, "Would you help me fill out the forms for the county to get my two birth certificates for my two kids?" And Tenzi said, "Sure." So she helped her fill out the forms. But there was a $28 processing fee for each birth certificate, which she could not afford. Tenzi said, "No problem. We can take care of that." So on the form, she wrote our debit card number so that they could charge our account. The very next day, we notice in our account $600 worth of merchandise purchased on Amazon using our debit card number. It was clear. It was clear. This woman had come regularly for food for her family. We had helped almost completely furnished her rental with furniture that had been donated. We had a relationship with her. But again, the feeling of betrayal, and again, the tendency to want to harden your heart. Tenzi went over and talked to her, and she wept. And the next week we took her a bag of food. But I think that's what it's about, is when you make a decision to open your heart, you do put yourself at risk. And then once you put yourself at risk, and we have tons and tons of stories of nothing going wrong, but there are times when things don't go right. And so the question is, are we making our hearts available not to just have the spaciousness, but also to be hurt, to be stung a little bit, and not allow that to change us to the point where we then close our hearts?
So it's not a day, almost an hour that passes that we're not hearing about the whole situation with immigration and the border wall and the caravan of people. And we're not policymakers and we're not news reporters. We're just people who've thrown in with those who are the immigrants in this state. And so we'd like to just share a story of just one of hundreds that we know. But I thought to actually, I had him come recently to just go over his story again, because he really is almost like the picture of what we keep hearing in the news. Alfonso is a young man, and he's from El Salvador, and he came actually as a 17-year-old. So when I was talking to him, and I was just taking notes, and among the things that touched me was how much trauma people carry in their bodies and in their hearts with the coming over. There is not a single story that I've ever heard in these many years that isn't harrowing. And you just wonder, how is it possible? And Alfonso is one of those stories. So let's see, 10 years ago, his mother left El Salvador because her husband had left the family. She had two young boys to raise, felt like there wasn't any way that she could make money in El Salvador, and so came. And so this would have been actually about 2004. And left Alfonso and the little brother with her mother. And Alfonso seemed to be one of these kids who loved school. And so the thought was that she would be able to come here, make some money, and be able to send money so that she could continue, or rather he could continue with studies, potentially even high school and then university. He was interested, as he grew, in perhaps becoming a nurse, a doctor. He wasn't sure. About the time that he was 15 years old, his grandmother felt that the situation around the neighborhood was such that he wasn't allowed to leave home, including to go to school, because the situation was that serious. He'd already, by age 15, seen an execution-style murder just at the store down the street. And something he said that I find so curious is that the gangs in Salvador, among the graffiti that they write on the walls is, in Spanish it says, ver, oír, silencio, which translates to see, hear, silence. So anything you see, anything you hear, you're really told to not say anything. And so he kept talking about just like this lawlessness and so a growing fear that the grandmother had that something would happen to him. His aunt had to pay what they call fenta, which is really extortion money that the gangs ask, and they protect you, your household, if you give them money each week. If you don't, something's going to happen. So in this environment, he felt that he would risk his life staying. So instead, he pleaded with his grandmother and decided to make the long journey here. He was taken across the border into Mexico, where in the traveling from any country in Central America, you're sort of passed along from guide to guide, or coyote to coyote, because not one person wants to try to figure out the entire journey. So it's almost like cartels of coyotes who sort of know how to bring the group of people to the next person. And so he was transferred to a guide in Mexico who, when they arrived in Oaxaca, told he and the 11 other people he was with, two of whom were young boys, 5 and 9, that they would have to go into a boat and from Oaxaca travel by boat sort of to the next state, north. He didn't know how to swim. So he said that he was on the shore and looking at the ocean, thinking, this might be where my life ends. But my only option is to go back, and my life will end there. So he decided to continue, got in the boat with the 11 others, and wouldn't you know it, a storm began, of course. And the waves, and he says the lightning and the rain, and the two little ones, the little boys, started yelling, crying. And the guide is yelling back to them to act like men, to shut up and act like men, 5 and 9. So Alvaro, in his both seasickness and probably just fear, started throwing up, uncontrollably throwing up. And finally, and probably miraculously, the boat was brought onto shore, and it was the sun was coming up. So in fact, they had been out the 11 hours that they were told they would be. And when he got off the boat, he was once again greeted by yet another guide, but a woman was with this guide. And so the woman, seeing him so sick, offered him medicine. And he was very dubious as to whether or not he should take it, thinking it could be laced with something. But as he told the story, there's a Spanish saying, me encomiendo a Dios, I sort of like put my life in God's hands. And he did that, and he said actually the medicine did help. So from there, he was then transported to another place where he had to get into a truck with six of the other men. There were two trucks, and so six and five boys, really. And they were told to lay down on the bed of the truck and had hay placed over them to conceal them. And this is August in Mexico, so you can imagine the heat. And he said that he almost felt like he was being buried alive, and they were lying sort of sideways in the truck with the hay over them, and for some reason it was generating a kind of heat that he said he felt like his legs were being burnt, and he started sort of panicking and feeling like he'd have to get out. And as he's getting up to jump out of the moving truck, the truck sort of came to a stop, and he was able to get out, and he says that the heat still has him have scars on his legs. They transferred him to yet another vehicle that then took him to the actual border, where they told him he'd have to cross the Rio Grande. And he could see from his place that the border agents were waiting on the other side. And he knew and intended to turn himself into the border agents, hoping that because he was underage, he'd be welcomed in. He said that when he got to the other side, and not sure what would happen, one of the border agents, who he said was clearly Mexican-American, picked him up, took him in, gave him his coat. At this point, he was completely wet, and also offered him food, which he was both sort of shocked and amazed that a border agent would be this kind. That was one border agent, because when that border agent then transferred him to a first facility that he would be at, he was then greeted by another border agent who was convinced that he was not 17 years old, and so took him out of this holding cell that had 40 other boys in there. He said it was so tight you couldn't even lay down, that you could only sit there and you'd be there for days. And this second border agent put him in with the men. He said that he'd never experienced his body shaking with so much fear, and he wasn't sure if it was the cold or the anxiety or both. He said he couldn't stop shaking. But wouldn't you know it, while he was there with the men, a third border agent took pity on him, questioned him, and realized that in fact he was 17. So put him back in with the kids. He then, from there, was taken to the place that we always see in the news, those warehouses that have cages around them and the foil blankets, and he was there for 2 weeks. He said, though, that all the boys were so frightened that they just almost congealed, and he said that they had this sense of brotherhood with one another because they were all in the same predicament. Alfonso was very, very lucky because he actually, from there, got sent to New York, of all places, to be in a group home there. And he said that he'd never flown before and never thought in his life he would, but that he arrived in New York and he said, and I also saw the Statue of Liberty. And so after 2 months of being in that group home where he said he was actually cared for very, very well, he's now in Guadalupe, and he's waiting for his immigration status to be determined. And after about an hour and a half of his storytelling, I asked him, was it worth it? Would you do it again? And he responded, I'd be dead now if I hadn't come. And I'm here only by the grace of God and the mercy of this country.
So, you know, we had heard that story before, and Tenzi did have Alfonso over to just freshen up her mind on the story. That, I mean, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't welcome this man? Who of us would not say, no, you don't need to be welcomed like this. Let's welcome you with open arms and love. You're fleeing your country for your life. So I think that's the reason that Tenzi wanted to tell this specific story, is we have to allow our hearts to be opened up. We just have to allow them to be opened up. So what is it about the Good Samaritan that caused him to stop and take care of a complete stranger, a stranger that had been passed by people in his own faith and tradition? Why did he do that? And I wonder if maybe that he himself, the Samaritan himself, hadn't at one time or another in his life felt the sting of being marginalized, being cast out. And I wonder if it didn't have him identify with this man. So the question is, if we, even when we're feeling fearful or insecure, can we get in touch with our own wounds and thereby identify with the stranger who crosses our path? We often look to those we admire for inspiration along the path, the Greg Boyles or the Oscar Romeros or the Dorothy Days. But as important as it is to appreciate their deeds, the more important takeaway is the common thread that runs through all of their lives, namely that they found the pearl of great value, the spaciousness of the heaven within, the gift that is available to all of us, and for which we may go to surprising lengths to obtain. There are those among us who are not inclined to welcome the stranger, who have disdain for the refugee, the homeless, the mentally ill, or the other. Those who reject the stranger may, in fact, themselves seem like strangers to us. It is important for us to welcome these strangers as well. It may be easier to dismiss them, demonize them, confront them, but it's good to remember that all of us have been invited to the banquet, and none of us have more entitlement to the banquet than anyone else. It's not our banquet, it's God's banquet. The unconditional love of God has showered down on all of us. God has welcomed us, And we are invited to welcome others as well. So the writer Annie Lamott said this: "We know we have created God in our own image, when it turns out God hates all the same people that we do." So let's not create God in our image, but instead try to live the image of God we were created to be, and welcome every stranger for who they really are, God's beloved child.
Well, let's take our break then, and we'll come back and whatever. Oh, no, from Christian. I'll let you make the announcement. Catherine. Oh, Catherine. Yes, I did. So don't. Yes, don't forget to pick up your Valentine at the snack table. Valentine quote. Thank you.